Welcome. You are listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Conference podcast. I am the center's deputy director, Marianne Page. In January 2014, the center hosted the War on Poverty Conference. The conference hosted top poverty experts from across the country to discuss the U.S. safety net on the 50-year anniversary of the War on Poverty. In this presentation, Douglas Miller discusses research on Head Start and evaluates some recent study findings. Miller is an associate professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, a faculty affiliate of the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research, and a faculty research fellow for the National Bureau of Economic Research.
This talk is comprised of a three-point agenda. The three points agenda are to talk a little bit about the history of Head Start, or at least some excerpts from the history of Head Start, and about the history of debates and puzzles surrounding Head Start. Talk a little bit about what we know and why we know so little about the long-run effectiveness of Head Start, and then to offer I don't have results, but I have a preview or an advertisement of ongoing work that's been going on. These first two bullet points are derived from work that I've done with Jens Ludwig and Chloe Gibbs, who's here, and the third bullet point derives from work that I've done with a team of stellar graduate and undergraduate students here at UC Davis. So I'm going to be excited to share all of that with you, and so without further ado. We all know and love Head Start. Now, given that, I'm not going to do the sort of basic core history. I just want to tell a few anecdotes or stories that might provide a little bit of color about the program. First, it was this conference is timed to be 50 years from the big speech. It was not in the speech. It was just not in the speech. It was its existence is possibly due to an accidental convergence of three different things. First of all, the Community Action Program, the core part of OEO, was starting to spend some money organizing communities. This was causing problems for local power structures. Word was getting around to mayors, this is some federal money you don't want. And Sergeant Stryver was having trouble spending the money. And so they're like, well, what can we spend money on? He had his research team say, give me a big picture of research. Maybe they made a pie chart or something, because he said, when I saw the chart and I saw how many of these poor people were kids, I almost fell out of my chair. So they knew they had to do something for kids. Two was Sergeant Shriver was married to Eunice Kennedy Shriver, who was the next sister in line after Rosemary Kennedy. Rosemary Kennedy had some sort of mental delay, a developmental delay, mental disability. It's not totally clear to me. I don't know the Kennedy history fully, but that brought Kennedy's attention on mental retardation issues. President Kennedy had the Presidential Commission on Mental Retardation, in which Eunice Kennedy Shriver, Sergeant Shriver's wife, was the unofficial head of that commission. And through that, they started learning about patterns in what we would today call socioeconomic disparities in cognitive functioning, what they then called cultural backwardness and mental retardation. And they started to learn about the environmental influences in the early years of schooling, and that was also part of what led to thinking about Head Start as an intervention that could be at work. And then finally, there was sort of politics, and OEO didn't want to lose out on the chance for the funding of this early kid intervention. So that was part of the sort of history. This happened all at the last minute. They decided to go forward with it basically in January 65 with the intent to have 100,000 kids by the summer of 65. It got called around D.C. Project Rush Rush. So here's one anecdote about that. Sergeant Shriver took it to Johnson to approve. Johnson said, okay, go for it. So then he calls the head of Head Start, Jules Sugarman. He wasn't the actual head, but he was the COO head. And Sergeant Shriver says, how much is this going to cost? And Jules Sugarman says, well, we don't really know. I'll have to look into that some more. Shriver says, fine, you have an hour. So Jules Sugarman in his oral report says, me and another guy went across the way, took an hour and a ham sandwich at the hotel, and we had back of the envelope calculation would be $180 a kid for an 8-week program. So he calls Sergeant Shriver back, and then the White House budget press office, like the next day or the day after that, says, we estimate it's going to be $180 a kid. And then when all the proposals start coming in from around the country, people estimating their programs, they think, oh yeah, we can do this for $180 a kid. And so that's basically what set the term and the scope of the program to start off with. So we talk about back of the envelope calculations. Here's a policy relevant one. Okay, let me think. What's next here? So the only other thing that's going to be relevant for this story is that this is federal money but administered locally, local programs. So that's going to play a role later on. The other way to think about Head Start history is to think about the money and people. So here's the money over its history, and then here's the people. Start off more people because it was a summer program, and then here's its growth. And we can think of this story in four parts. Basically, the sort of Wild West or maybe Wild South during the early implementation, a period of relative stability, big growth, and then another little bit more period of stability. Throughout, one thing that's constant over this is just a huge perceived success. So this one book I was reading starts on page one. Why was Head Start such a success, a reporter recently asked me, and why was the rest of the poverty a failure? So that was a book from about this era. A national representative study from about this era had a 92% approval rating for Head Start, and you can come up with lots of anecdotes. So why is it perceived as such a success? I think that there's probably, it's a special combination of fairness and efficiency. So, you know, one of the things of which economists hold true and dear to our hearts is the fundamental issue of trade-offs, of opportunity costs, and brought to macro perspectives, we think of this as the trade-off between fairness and efficiency. But this is one of those circumstances where we feel like maybe you can have it both. So in particular, fairness, we're targeting those who are in disadvantage, and not just those who are in disadvantage, but what a great target demographic, right? I mean, 3- and 4-year-olds is this amazing mixture of play, of discovery, of people who are, you know, sort of innocent. You can't blame them for their poverty, but also sort of in contrast to babies, growing into their own personhood in the eyes of people outside of their own family in ways that you could, our empathy things that really just have to be going on. So here's one sense of the sort of fairness aspect of it. This sort of power was not lost on the OEO. In fact, that was part of why Sergeant Shriver was excited to have this in community action programs, which was getting a bad name. You put the cute kids in, and now it doesn't have a bad name, right? So here, for instance, is, I don't have a presidential picture, but here's a first lady. This is Lady Bird Johnson meeting with Head Start kids in the early 60s. And then one of the small themes of this talk is the more things change, the more they stay the same. Here's Michelle Obama with the same smile meeting with these kids. So
the same scarf.
The same scarf, yes. Now, some things have changed. The healthy snack today, you can't quite tell very clearly, but it's raw broccoli and bread rolls, whereas in the 1960s, it appears to be raw ground beef. So some things have changed. Okay. So there's also efficiency aspects of Head Start. The efficiency aspects come from thinking about the investments in early childhood leading to long-run benefits. So we can use terms like neuroplasticity, dynamic complementarities in learning, the technology of skill formation. My co-author Jens in another paper says, well, we think this passes a benefit-cost test. So that's the efficiency. That's that we have it. We have our equity and we have our efficiency too. Okay. The title of this talk is Long-Run Puzzles in Head Start Research. And I mean that title in two ways. One way is that some of these puzzles, some of these debates about Head Start have been going on for a long time. There's some recurring themes that happen from the very beginning of the program up to today are, well, does the program work? Does it do what we want it to do? And related to that is this ongoing question of test score fade out, where we find test score positive impacts at Head Start that then fade out to zero. So that's one recurring theme. Related to that is the policy question of should this program be expanded, strangled, fundamentally changed, or what? If we're going to do more, do we want to have just more kids, or do we want to be changing the resource intensity of the program is another debate. And then similarly, even separate from dollars, do we want to be having the focus be a pre-academic or academic skills, or do we want to have the focus be a whole child skill? So these are themes that recur throughout the history of the Head Start debates, and that's one sense. Let me just think about one example of the test score fade out. I'm going to talk a little bit more, but in 1965, the head of OEO says to Jules Sugarman, the same guy that had to do the $180 estimate, Sergeant Shriver says, now, I want to prove this program is valuable. In fact, I'd like to say how many IQ points are gained for every dollar invested. Right? And Jules Sugarman says, Sarge, that's only part of what Head Start is about. And Sarge says, I want it done. Right? So that's the precursor for thinking about sort of the academic versus whole child and the does it work question. And we'll see that precursor echoes through today. Okay. The other meaning of the title of this talk, Long Run Puzzles in Head Start Research, is just what the heck is the long-run impact. We really want to know, because that's the question that we care about in terms of this program, and it's a key question, but it's a hard question. And it's a hard question for, I think, three reasons, which are pretty well known, but let me refresh us on those reasons. Reason one is the same reason it'd be hard to measure the short-run impact, which is that fundamentally, it's a perennial challenge of identifying any sort of causal effect in non-experimental settings, which is the people that don't go to Head Start are poor comparisons for the people that do attend Head Start. Those who don't sign up don't tell us very much about those who do sign up and what their counterfactuals would be. They're different because to attend Head Start, you need to be poor enough. Your parents need to have the sort of wherewithal to try to get you to sign up. They may need to have the flexible job schedule so that you can conform with the hours of Head Start availability. And so all of those things may be different, and all of those things may in turn affect our long-run causal effects. So how we might usually think about dealing with this issue is to think about trying to find an experiment, which we have one very recently, or absent that, find one something that mirrors an experiment. One way to think about that sort of quasi-experimental strategy is based on the following. These variables, which are problematic in being able to measure Head Start, we might think of as being about the demand for Head Start. So does my parent want me to go there or not? But if we could identify a supply shock to Head Start, then we could use that to find kids who are otherwise observationally comparable, and then but one of whom, because of their supply shock, is able to get Head Start, and use that to look at the impacts. So that would be the standard sort of approach. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we know from that sort of thing. A little bit later. Okay, so that's the short-run difficulty and how we might approach it. The long one is even harder to measure because you're starting off with the same problem as the short-run effect, but then there's two additional difficulties. I think both these additional difficulties actually are themes that have resonated throughout the conference and the different programs we've been assessing through the conference. One of them is just the data problems are harder. It's harder to find data where you can look at exposure when you're young, outcomes when the long run has come around for you, and which additionally sort of enable the ability to do a quasi-experimental estimate. So that just sort of takes your difficulty and squares it. Okay. In addition, there's another challenge. The additional challenge is a challenge that we might think of external validity issues. Any estimate that we can get is going to be a valid estimate that speaks to the population of kids for that study, the program as it was enacted in that time, the counterfactual opportunity for those kids, where they stay at home, where they go to another daycare setting, or the like of that time. Because we're interested in long-run impacts, we can, at best, measure the impacts of the population, program, and alternatives from a long time ago, absent science fiction, time travel, right? So at best, we can do that. What that means is, at best, we can get the question we want for the population that we're not that interested in, right? So that's tough. It's just tough. So here's where I think the approach of the ideal situation for this might go. Let's start with what we could ideally at best do, which is identify the long-run impacts from earlier cohorts. Let's see if we can also, for those cohorts, identify short-run outcomes that might be sort of along the causal pathway for those long-run outcomes. This is sort of like in medicine, they have intermediate clinical endpoints and ultimate clinical endpoints. So, for instance, intermediate clinical endpoint might be blood pressure or a cholesterol level. When I give talks, that intermediate clinical endpoint of blood pressure is not doing so good, right? The ultimate clinical endpoint might be cardiovascular mortality. We want to think about the analog. Sorry, I don't mean to be. I didn't mean to bring it that close to home there. But we need to think about the analogs for this in the context of determinants of long-run outcomes for exposure to this program. So what we'd like to do is find those for those earlier cohorts. Additionally, we'd like to be able to find a stable relationship between the short-run outcomes and the long-run outcomes, so that we know which of the possible short-run or intermediate clinical endpoints are the ones that we should be tracking. And that lets us know which ones we should be looking at today in order to project what the long-run impacts of today's program might be. That's the model for how the research endeavor might go. And as you can expect, we're a long ways off from meeting the promise of that model. But let's start with what we can, okay? What we can, so let me tell you a little bit about the best direct measures of long-run impacts that we have of Head Start. I think there's probably two types of best available direct measures of long-run impacts. One type is based on sibling comparisons, two families where one child went to Head Start and one child did not. These are, it's a really shame that Janet Curry couldn't be here today, because this is really pioneered by Janet Curry in conjunction with Duncan Thomas and in one of the papers, Aileon and Garces. And one using the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth and then followed up by David Deming. That's where the long-run outcomes come in. And the other using a panel study of income dynamics. So that's one type of best available evidence we have on long-run impacts. And I'm going to give you some more details about the type of evidence that's found in that in just a minute. The other is a paper I wrote in conjunction with Jens Ludwig, and that's using one of these supply shocks that I alluded to earlier, where in the early years of the Head Start program, we can identify county by county. Some counties got basically an extra supply shock of Head Start due to a quirk in the initial rollout of Head Start, and we can find sets of counties that are otherwise comparable, but where one got more Head Start and one got less. And we try to use that as a way to measure the impact. So I'm going to give you a sense of the flavor of these two types of studies. Here is from the Garces, Thomas, and Curry study, looking at PSID data, where they can actually track kids over a long time, and they can find siblings, one of whom went to Head Start, one of whom didn't, and track them into their early adulthood, in their 20s. And so what I'm going to show you are coefficients on three outcomes. One is, did the child graduate from high school? One is, did the child attend some college? And one was the person, ever by the time they were in their 20s, ever booked or arrested for a crime? And these are each little cell is going to be the results of a different regression. And so let me just show that to you. And they look at everybody pooled, African-American kids only and white kids only. And so let me just focus on this corner here because it's easiest and it has stars. In this sort of comparison, we can see that the findings are that if you look at siblings, the child that got Head Start exposure was 20 percentage points more likely to have graduated from high school than the child that didn't within that family. And they would rule out the zero effects for that. And then similarly, there's an increase in college going. And those educational impacts were not found in that study. This is, mind you, a study from about a decade or so ago using data from about 15 or so years ago. And this is not my own work. I just want to make sure I'm this is the lit review part here, I guess. Those findings were not found for African-American kids, although there was a large and statistically significant reduction in having been booked or charged for some crime. So in some sense, this paper, which is one of the main planks, this is probably the key results of those main planks of the long-run evidence. So that's one flavor of the sibling comparison literature. The other main literature another main plank is my paper with Jens, in which there was a grant writing assistance for Head Start that some counties got that other similar counties didn't get, and we show that translates into increased dollars per kid of 50 to 100% more Head Start resources per kid in those counties that got the assistance, which in turn led to more schooling attainment, maybe about a half year of achieved attainment, maybe about 2 to 3 percentage points increase in attending college, which is about 15% of the control mean, and a reduction in child mortality. Okay, so. Here's a picture of the reduction in child mortality where these are the poorer counties that got the assistance that have lower mortality, and these are the counties that didn't have assistance that had higher mortality. So there's a third plank here, which is not yet a public paper, but about a half year ago in this room, Rucker Johnson came and presented what I would say is promising in-progress research, again, using the PSID and linking it to some county year funding data related to the data that Martha talked about this morning that I'm about to talk about in a few minutes, and he found beneficial effects on schooling, wages, incarceration, and health. So the optimistic take on all of this can be drawn from Rucker's slides, which is to say, he says, look, we've estimated long-term benefits for previous cohorts from three separate research designs and from three separate data sets. In fact, maybe five separate data sets when you add them all together. So that's the take. So is there a consensus on Head Start's effectiveness? No. Here's the early part of that non-consensus from 1969. I should say, let me take a step back, sorry. The first reported reports of test score fade-out, problematic test score fade-out, was in 1966, which is to say, 1 year after the first program was about the first time you could measure fade-out. That was some New York City program. So this is coming up page A1 of the New York Times in 1969 in the wake of the first nationally representative study. Head Start pupils found no better off than others. It says, accordingly, the authors have told the administration the preschool program is not worth the cost in its present form. Right. So that's from a long time ago. Here's from a more recent thing a couple years ago, an article appropriately titled Time to Axe Public Programs That Don't Yield Results, in which he says, of indisputable evidence, Head Start simply does not work. He says, further funding is criminal, likens it to tax breaks for oil companies. Right? So, yeah. So we do not have a consensus here. I was, in today's New York Times, David Brooks's column, let's see if we can, I can't do it. He's got a sort of, everything doesn't work on the left or the right. He says, conservative programs like urban enterprise zones fail to produce measurable results. Liberal programs like Head Start scarcely produce identifiable long-term gains. Okay, so now I need to get back to my slides here. And is this going to, okay, great. Oh, no. Presentation. Okay, great. So we've seen the optimistic take based on long-run impacts. We've seen a pessimistic take based on test score fade-out. Oh, I want to say one more thing about that test score fade-out. This very negative assessment of Head Start was based on the results of the National Head Start Interview Impact Survey, which was also nationally representative and was a gold standard in terms of assessing causal impacts. It was based on randomized assignment to Head Start versus non-Head Start. And so there's the evidentiary basis for that fade-out, test score fade-out is a relatively strong evidentiary basis. Okay, so we have some optimistic takes and some pessimistic takes. The optimists have a rejoinder. They have a couple rejoinders. Rejoinder one is, this fade-out that we're so concerned about was present even in the cohorts for whom we saw long-run impacts. So this fade-out is not necessarily a signal that there won't be long-run impacts, because we saw the fade-out and long-run impacts together. So David Deming's paper for the same sets of kids sees test score gains, fade-out, long-run benefits. My findings with Jens and Garces, Thomas, and Curry aren't quite the same cohort as the Westinghouse, but they're pretty close. And so we think that there may be those cohorts experienced fade out, but also long run gains. Additionally, other programs targeted at the same ages, like the Perry Preschool program, and I forget if it's smaller class size or better teachers from the Tennessee Star program, found test score gains, then test score fade outs, and long run benefits. So maybe that's not so damning as we would originally be concerned. Separately, the optimistic rejoinder number two is maybe we can find other mechanisms where we actually find effects. So Alex Gelber and co-author of using that experiment that found, recent experiment, NHSAS experiment, found increases in parent involvement with kids. Hillary and co-authors have been maybe finding some impacts on subgroups, though actually I think I misunderstood. For Spanish-speaking kids, they find impacts that persist. Right? So people can find some mechanisms where maybe something's going on. So that's optimism, pessimism, optimism rejoinders. Now, to misuse the misused historian's word of the conference, let me complicate things again. And so let me offer the pessimist rejoinders to this, and then I'll stop at some point. Don't worry, it's not just infinite regress. Okay. Pessimism rejoinder one is people have tried to measure other things other than cognitive impacts, like non-cognitive impacts in this, and find nothing. And look, at some point we have to ask ourselves, are we, maybe subconsciously, but doing a fishing expedition? Is this sort of not intending, but basically like data mining, because we know what we want to find for Head Start. What we want to find is that, cute kids are brought to success through this program. And is that influencing the sort of research findings that we think of as meaningful and implicitly keep or discard? So that's rejoinder one. And here's pessimist rejoinder number two, is bullet point one up there, that long run evidence, may not be so bulletproof as we think. And so here's what I want to walk you through that in a couple of steps. I'm going to say some negative things about a couple of papers. Let me start with my own. Before I say these negative things, I want to put down a marker. I think this is a great paper, and I'm very proud of it. we just shouldn't over-interpret the effects we find. Okay. So our paper is cited for its Head Start impacts in two dimensions. One is educational gains, and one is health. So thinking about the educational gains, we do find some educational gains, but our results basically have marginal statistical significance and sometimes sensitivity specification. I mentioned a half a year increase in schooling. The t-statistic for that is 1.55. Right, so that's not, our other stuff on, we have a 3 percentage point increase in high school grads. We have a better p-value there, 0.032. So it's not like nothing. Although that census finding is based on finding people in their 20s and 30s, where they lived then, assuming that they went to Head Start in the counties of where they live now, and then attributing the program based on that. So there's real concerns about migration. Now, in our defense, we're very upfront about that. We do all that we can. We argue that, but still, we should take this as evidence as suggestive, not conclusive. Our health gains, we do find some reductions in mortality due to Head Start susceptible causes, but these are basically things that are about severe malnutrition and or things for which under immunization was just rampant in the 60s and 70s, so things like anemias, meningitis, tuberculosis, other things like that. So that was, and even in the 60s and 70s, that was a small fraction of child mortality. It's a much smaller fraction now. So if we think about the sort of external validity concerns or how much do we want to extrapolate from that to today, maybe we want to think of this as a metaphor, a hope that this is a metaphor for today's programs, but hope on a metaphor is not quite the same thing as confidence in the long-run impacts of today's programs. Okay, so additionally, I want to talk a little bit about reassessing some of the sibling comparisons estimates, and I want to talk in particular about the paper by Garces, Thomas, and Curry. And there's sort of three points of caution I want to have as we interpret that paper. Point one is a well-known concern about sibling comparisons, which is just the issue of what led one sibling to go to Head Start and the other not to. Was there something special about that kid or something special about their parents? And then we're basically back to the same problem with non-experimental research designs. The other points have to do with this replication and extension project that I've been involved with this collection of stellar graduate students here at Davis. And I would say my interpretation of this work that we've done here is to indicate that the sibling comparison estimates in this study, we should interpret as suggestive, not definitive. And so I want to walk you through that a little bit more. And so we reconstructed the PSID sample, and we did pretty good. we did pretty good. We got good sample means. Our observational regressions looked pretty good until it comes time to do the sibling comparison regressions, and then we didn't quite do so good. So I'm going to show you those. These are the same results that I just showed you before. This is the original study, and then I'm going to show you a parallel, which is our study with our data that we can. And what we're going to see, I'm just going to tell you, is that there's going to be some differences in colors and stars. Our numbers aren't going to be pointed. They're all going to be within a standard error. So it's like a pretty good, but not perfect. And so the basic pattern is it's a little weaker here, a little weaker here, a little stronger here, or not. You know, it's pretty good. Okay. Part of digging into, well, what were these discrepancies? We spent a lot of time trying to find the discrepancies, right? And we still have more investment to do on that. But one of the things we learned in thinking about those discrepancies is that there may be less variation in these sorts of estimates than you would think there would be. So let me spell this out for you a little bit more by talking about what's behind this coefficient. Now, mind you, this coefficient here is not a starred coefficient, but I understand what's going on behind it very well. And we're trying to figure out why do we have a different number here than there. And this is what led us to put a pause on our replication efforts. The sample size in these sorts of estimates may be much smaller than you might think. So, for instance, for looking at the African-American sibling example, we have 627 kids who have siblings. But for looking at the Head Start impacts, we don't just need to know who has siblings. We need to have what family where one kid went into Head Start and one kid didn't. However, 94% of these kids, neither of them went to Head Start. In fact, we have about 50 kids where one kid went to Head Start and one kid didn't. Of those, maybe 13 kids in the sample were ever booked or charged with a crime. So those estimates that we have are basically about how are these 13 kids distributed amongst the 50. And at that point, we realize you get one kid wrong, or you have one family off, or these numbers are going to be very sensitive to minor specification choices. And so that just, I think, underlies a lot of these sibling comparison samples more generally. And I think doesn't mean that there's not suggestive evidence of effects, but maybe does mean that it's not as conclusive as we would want. However, putting that concern aside, or maybe because of that concern, we took a couple of steps to expand the sample size. Time has marched on. We now can make more comparisons than we could have 15 years ago. We can bring in more siblings, and some people, previously there were comparisons, but they were too young to have long-run outcomes, and now they do. Additionally, the people for whom, some of these people have aged into their 30s and 40s, so we can look at even longer-run outcomes. So here's what happens when we expand our sample size. This is before. This is our original sample, before adding in extra observations from expanding sample size, and here's after we add in the extra observations. So this is probably what I think of as the current best evidence using the PSID design in sibling comparisons. We have our ends have almost tripled. Our standard errors are much smaller than in the smallest. So we have much more precise estimates. And basically, we find nothing for high school impacts, no impacts for these outcomes for African-American kids. This is the one finding that sort of seems to stick through, some college education. Though it's a smaller estimate, maybe it's moved from too large to be believed into more plausible sized impact estimate. Okay, so that's the... Oh, we also look at a bunch of longer-run outcomes and find a lot of nothing. Okay, so... So that's the pessimism rejoinders. Okay, so just to remind us of the goal here, we want to be able to find long-run impacts from early cohorts, trace them to short-run outcomes, the intermediate clinical endpoints, find a stable relationship so that we can know what to look at today. And basically, my punchline here is I think we're a long way off from that. And so that's my transition. That's bullet points one and two of the talk. And I want to talk next about a preview of some ongoing work that's going on here at Davis that I don't have results for you all here. But I'm really excited about the promise that this ongoing work has to help resolve the lack of knowledge that I hopefully have convinced you that we currently have. So that's what's next. And I'm not sure where I'm at on time. I just want to...
You've got 20 minutes left.
Excellent. This work is very, very preliminary, and so I need to... you know how when you download software, there's an end user license agreement? You know, things like, I recognize that this software may crash my computer, or it may put cookies on my computer and loses all my data privacy. So I have an end user licensing agreement for the preliminary results that I'm about to show you here, including the PSID ones I did just show you. So let me see here. These results are extremely preliminary. They may change. I'm not going to take them too seriously. Oh, as is with any end user licensing agreement, of course, there's going to be cookies, right? But thankfully, as Greg alluded to, we have cookies here already, the type you eat, right? So... Okay. So with that in mind, let me tell you about this work. This work is preliminary enough that this is the state of the three projects and the titles. They're all sort of projects in search of titles. And I've already told you about Project 1. which is the PSID project that we're doing. So what I'm going to talk next about is projects 2 and 3, one of which is a big data project, and the other of which is our first work at using that data. All of these projects are a joint work with Aro Marek, Esther Kose, Nama Shanav, Michelle Gross, and Natalie Ho. And it has just been my delight and incredible good fortune to work with this team. It has been amazing. Anything that looks like a result that I have shown you or I'm about to show you would be not possible without them. Ariel, Esra, Michelle, and Nama are all third-year PhD students in our program, so you guys don't get to try to compete for them as junior colleagues yet, but in a couple of years you'll have the opportunity, and I'll be glad to let you know that you should be struggling hard for them. Natalie just recently graduated with a bachelor's degree here from Davis, is taking coursework in preparation for PhD programs, and it would be an asset to your program. So we'll do proud by you. Okay, so let me talk about these programs a little bit, or these projects. The first project is a big data project, and it's basically a project meant to build data that can give us supply shocks on Head Start exposure. And I want to build two panels of Head Start funding data, one at the state year level and one at the county year level. And I have to say, I thought the state year aspect would just be like an hour's work, or you know, maybe it would just go find out, you know, you can find this state got this much Head Start real easy for recent years, and you think it should be there. We haven't yet found it, and so that's been the first part that I want to tell you a little bit about. We, especially Natalie, have scoured high and low the virtual and real world, and here's what we've found from OEO reports, from statistical fact sheets, from NCS Digest, from budget reports, and so on and so forth. We've been able to cobble together here, there, and another, and I'll show you what the state of that project is. Information on funding and sometimes enrollment, and so this is going to be something we're going to use in two ways. Way one is the sort of whale for this is the county year panel, and this will help us validate that, and it will help us sort of check that and clean that. But it's also going to be a direct source of measure that we can use, and I'm going to show you some work on a project for that. In addition, we need to combine it with information on the at-risk population, whether at-risk is defined by kids of the right age or maybe poor kids of the right age. So let me show you the data we have so far of our state year panel. The solid gray line here is just the national published Head Start and funding, and the blue dots are the years for which we have data for all states. So for those years for which we have data for all states, we sum them all up and compare them to the nationally published numbers, and as you can see, the blue dots are pretty good. Look, it follows the pattern, the levels are pretty close, it's not so bad. You can see there's some gaps starting in the 80s and 70s and 60s. So we're not yet done. We have more work to do on this. But I would say, you know, it's looking pretty good. Do I have more to say about that? I don't think so. Oh, yeah, here's how it looks. Here's how it looks, not just what data we have, but here's the whole data set. We plot out for each line is a state and its time series of Head Start funding per child over the course of the program's inception to today. We have a log scale here, so you can see there's really been a massive growth. This is the growth period, this level, the big ramp up in the 90s in the level. And you can see a few things here. Thing one is we haven't finished with our data cleaning. Right? Thing two is there's huge state-to-state variability in Head Start exposure per child. And if we had enough time to stare at this, there's state-to-state variability in the trends of Head Start exposure per child. The thing three is Mississippi has a lot more money than the rest of us. I mean, not, you know, in terms of Head Start money for child, partly because of poverty, and we can look at the per poor numbers here shortly too. So that's basically the result of the state year data collection to date, and I'm going to use that after telling you about the other part of the data collection project. So the next part was a county year panel, and in Martha's talk this morning, she was very, very nicely said, I've worked on some data, not talking about the sort of hours of sweat and blood that she and her collaborators have put into that, and she said, I'm not going to tell you about the construction, I'm just going to use it, and that's, unfortunately, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about what we've done in a parallel effort. There's two sources of this data, Community Action Program funding data and Federal Outlay System files. This conference is co-sponsored by the All You See History Group, and Greg Clark the other day was telling me he's not economic history if your data comes in electronic format. And I think these data files prove that wrong. They come in electronic format that you can go to Bethesda, Maryland, to the National Archives and get or order, but they're not usable. So let me tell you a little bit about the wrestling we've done with it so far. They're very messy. There's no decent documentation. There's three examples that I have. But this is like three from a list of, I don't know, 6 to 12 we've worked with so far, and another probably dozen or two that we have to deal with to get this data into shape. you look to see the funding, how much funding a county got, and you see letters instead of numbers. You know, not always there's like number, letter, right? So that we've been able to fix, because that's not that big one. I want to tell you about Amite County, Mississippi. Amite County, Mississippi is a county of 14,000 people on the border with Louisiana. It has about three or four towns and about three Head Start centers. And if you look at the funding profile in the data, it's like 1972 it has $800,000 of Head Start funds. 1973 it has $900,000 of Head Start funds. 1974 it has $280 million of Head Start funds. 1975 it has $900,000 of Head Start funds. And so, in fact, the entire time series for the whole country is blown off of its trajectory because of Amite County in 1974. And so there's just like, that's an example of sort of the messiness you get. Similarly, separately, in New York and New Jersey, their funding disappears in 1974. And it's not, didn't just move to Amite because they lost collectively about $30 million, whereas Amite had about an extra $280 million. So something special and wrong was going on in 74, but in general, there's a mess. Okay. We've done a lot of cleaning work so far, and we have lots left to do, but so far our data quality is a decent start, so I want to show you a little bit about what we have in hand from that right now. This is a similar picture to what I was showing you before, but focusing on 65 to 80, which is the years for which we have county data. Then again, this again is the national numbers, which are sort of published everywhere. These blue dots come from our state year panel, so this is what I've sort of already checked, and the red circles are our new county year funding aggregated up to the national level. So again, it was looking pretty good. Before Amite County was cleaned up, this was up here. You know, so it's looking pretty good. It's not perfect. Again, we don't have, for this county year data now, we can check not just against the national trends, but for some years we have pairs of state and county, and so we can look at cross-sectional comparisons state by state using our state data and our county data. So here, for instance, in 1966 is how the state data funding per state and the county data aggregated up to the state look. And it's, you know, it's not great, but it's not bad. In fact, it's worse than it looks here because this is a log scale, so these differences are pretty big. This difference reflects the fact that the county on the whole is higher than the state for that year. This is the same. This is the same picture as this right here. Here's for 70, 75, and 80. And in fact, the correspondence looks better for the other years. So we're going to take this as a sort of preliminary, partial validation of the county data as we've got so far. And before leaving the data project, I'm going to just sort of show you what the county data looks like in that similar sort of spaghetti type picture for just two states, just to get a sense for Alabama and for California. And so here's the county specific Head Start funding for 3 and 4 year olds for every county in Alabama, and the same numbers in California. And again, you can see we have more cleaning to do, but there's a lot of variability both over time and cross counties. And understanding that variability gives us a chance to find supply shocks for access to Head Start for kids that we can then learn about the long-run impacts of Head Start. So that's a sort of the promise down the road for that data set. Now, to wrap things up, I do want to tell you about how we've been using, this is my second ask. Think wrapping up the data part of the project. They have potential, but they need a lot of work. In fact, I think anybody working with this data has to talk about the work they've done for it to be credible work. It's difficult to even know what to check against. And I'm excited for leads and suggestions as we help to fill this out or find data against which to validate it. That's my second ask here is helps on that, the next steps for that. Okay, so now using that data, I want to talk about using the state year panel and using this big ramp up in the 1990s to see is there something that we could use to learn about the impacts of Head Start. So, just to remind you, there was a big ramp up of funding of Head Start in the 1990s. Okay, so now with the state year panel constructed, we can start to say, well, how did that ramp up impact different states? Did they all get the same? Did they all grow proportionately? What can we learn about that? And so here's what we can learn about that. This is looking on the x-axis, the dollars per poor child in 1990 for each state before the ramp up. On the y-axis, the dollars per poor child in 2001. There's a lot in this picture, so let me tell you a little bit. First of all, there's a lot of variability state to state before. There's a lot of variability state to state after. The growth, even for states that started off at the same spot, can be very, very different. And some of that's driven by small states that could just be measurement noise, like North Dakota. But you can't quite see here, but I spent a little bit of time staring around. Pennsylvania's right around here. No. Where's New... there's a Pennsylvania right in this axis somewhere. We have a Pennsylvania, New York, where... I'm going to give up.
Below Maine.
I have the problem of too much help, and the problem of the front of the room syndrome. So let me tell you that Pennsylvania and New York both started off at the same, and New York may be doubled, and Pennsylvania may be quadrupled its Head Start funding. And so there's big variation. This is the main point. There's also some equalization, some equalizing of the funds. But not perfect equalization, as you can see. Okay, so just lots of variations.
What's going on with America?
Oh, there's a lot of mysteries to be resolved. I don't... absolutely point of curiosity. And this is a two-point... So I don't know if one of the other years was special or funny in either our estimates of dollars or of kids or of child poverty rates. We have work to do on checking all three of those pieces. And when you're looking at changes, we have to learn more into that. Okay, very good. So this begs the question, what was behind the variation from state to state in the growth of Head Start funds during this ramp-up period, and what can we learn about that? Here's one candidate answer, is in fact there's legislative language that's supposed to guide the allocation of Head Start funds to states. The states don't touch the money, they don't direct the money, but still, the laws are written by senators, and so they say how states should get the money. And so we've a separate part of the data project been collecting throughout the history legislative language on how appropriations are supposed to go for Head Start and the guidance. So here's an example from 1994, and the Head Start programs. And there's small print here. Don't worry, you don't have to read the small print. Here's the summary. You take the amount of money and you put some aside for running the program, for Indian and migrant programs, for R&D, stuff like that. Of what's left, each state gets however much they got in nominal dollars in 1981. And then of what's left after that, you put it into two pots. One-third of it gets allocated based on the number of 0 to 18-year-old AFDC folks. And the remaining two-thirds gets allocated based on the number of 0 to 5 kids in poverty. Interestingly enough, these pieces are two of the three pieces that Martha identified in her OEO allocation formula from the 60s, and this is here in the 1994 language. I would guess that there's some linkage between those, that somehow the unemployment got folded into poverty, and then that's how we got there. It's just a guess. So does this formula serve well as in predicting how that money actually was allocated in those scatter plots? Well, we took that formula, four ingredients, total amount of money, what was your 81 numbers? How many AFDC kids did you have? How many poor kids did you have? We've got a predicted level. And now with our state year panel, we know the actual level. So with that, we can plot them against each other. And I'm not plotting a regression line here. I'm only plotting a 45-degree line. And it looks pretty good, right? So we're feeling pretty good about that. Here's the same picture done for every year from 1990 to 2001. So we can see the growth. And it's not always perfect. And actually, they rewrote the law in 98 and started looking a lot better after they rewrote the law. So we can start to tell some stories there. So it looks pretty good. If we think about the growth state by state from 1990 to 2001, and we say, well, let's see, what was the actual growth and what would our formula predict for the growth? We'd put that into a regression format, and we get a coefficient of 1. A percentage point of predicted growth corresponds to a percentage point of actual growth. This is on a base level of about 200% growth per kid. If we put in some what we think are possible confounding variables, it's not just about poverty. It's not just about changes in the fraction of poor. It's not just about changes in the share of the number of poor people. We can throw in a bunch of other variables that sometimes are predictive themselves, although very economically small coefficients, but never really move that coefficient away from 1. And so we think our formula is really telling us what's going on. So that's really exciting and holds great promise for the ability to use this formula and use this new data to learn about the impacts of Head Start. Now, sad to report, I don't have that next step for you now, but hopefully to come soon. What's additionally exciting about this sort of research design is that in order to implement it, all that we need is to know where were you a kid, which state were you, and what cohort were you, and there's a lot of data sets that have that, including a lot of data sets that have a lot of outcomes, plenty of intermediate clinical endpoints that we might want to look at, and so that's just, it holds great promise. I'm very excited about it. Additionally, at the state level, we might think of migration as less of a concern. Additionally, we know about the legislative language not just during the ramp-up period, but also we know what happened after, and we know what happened before, at least into about the 70s or so. And so there's the potential to really understand much of, maybe not all, but much of what drove funding to different states and how different kids might have been exposed to Head Start throughout most of the program's history. And so this is just the beginning of a research agenda to come. I'm really excited for that. So here's my conclusion. I am going to come in under. Great. My conclusion is, we all know and love Head Start, but maybe we don't know as much as we should, and so there's the risk that maybe we love it more than we should. We need to know more. We need to learn more, and so stay tuned. So that's what I've got. So thanks. Okay.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening.
The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.